I'm pleased to welcome to the KALW studios a true public radio icon, someone who continues to craft creative broadcasts that are interesting and innovative, responsible for more driveway moments, I think, than anyone in the medium today. Ira Glass, host and producer of This American Life. Welcome.
It's very nice to be here.
This has been a year of, tumult, triumph, tragedy for you and your creative team, if you allow me the alliteration on that, and maybe some other T's I'm not aware of.
No, that was just beautiful. that was good.
The tumult I'm thinking about was the whole Mike Daisy episode, and you could really hear in your voice how painful the whole experience was for you of that whole episode of deception and then the reconciling of the episode.
Yeah, do you want to talk about that? I mean, truthfully, I've tried to avoid talking about it since it happened because I feel like I said everything about him that I've got no beef with him still, and I don't like the idea that he would go online and see that I was still talking about him and still saying stuff about him. I feel like he should be allowed to just go, like, move past this and do the next thing in his life. And I would feel terrible if he felt like I keep going around, like, dredging this up. Like, he should be allowed to move on.
Well, we're not going to recap the whole incident here, but I'm sure in the aftermath, things are better for you as far as story preparation goes and your team being prepared for new works that come into your bailiwick.
I mean, up until that episode, we hadn't discovered that we had broadcast lies. You know, like we that hadn't happened before, and it hasn't happened since. And if anything, what happened from having him on the show, like in the months since, we've actually been much more aggressive about fact-checking and really fact-checking things. Like, we'll have, and it's a really weird thing to do, we'll have comedians and people like that come, you know, storytellers come on the show, and we will call their family and be sure everything is true. And it's so annoying for the performers and their family. I feel like we've really tried some people's patience.
Well, let's get the sadder things out of the way as well. The T for tragedy I'm thinking about is losing someone who you became quite close with, David Rakoff. Now, how did you guys first collaborate?
Rakoff, he was a friend of Sedaris's in the first couple years of the radio show, and I knew Rakoff before I put him on the air. And then he wrote this story about working as Christmas for it in a department store window that was so beautiful and funny and perfect for the show that it started to put him on the air. And he had always had the ambitions of being a writer, but hadn't been doing much writing. And I think being able to come onto the radio show was the excuse for him turning out a lot of material because we wanted more. And then he's such an amazing performer of his own work. He was a great actor and so that's how I got to know. I mean, it was just like one of those. It's funny. There have been a set of maybe a half dozen people who were writers who were just coming to the show at the point where they were starting to get very, very serious about their writing, and the writing was really flourishing. And he was one of them. And Sedaris was kind of a more advanced writer when he came to us, but still, like, he definitely. He definitely was growing as a writer. Sedaris is like his own thing. Like, he was so himself from the very beginning. But Sarah Val was somebody else. And Birbiglia, Mike Birbiglia, who we just did this movie with, is somebody who, like Rakoff came to the show at a certain point where he was, like, starting to write real stories with not just funny beats, but really emotional parts to them.
I just finished his book, right around the time of his death, I just finished his book, Fraud.
Yeah.
And one of the stories that he recounts is his stint as a living Sigmund Freud for the New York City holiday window display.
Yeah, no, that's the one that was our first one that we broadcast.
That
yeah.
You were patient. In
yeah. I was one of his patients. Yeah. I mean, it's been such a weird few months with him because he was in a live show that we did in May that we did on stage and beamed into movie theaters around the country. And so people here in San Francisco maybe saw it. And he performed a story about the fact that he's dying and what that's like. And he had lost use of one arm. And then he talked about how he had been a dancer in college and before that. And then he danced on stage. And it was really beautiful. And even at that time in May, he was saying that he didn't expect to live past August. He's like, okay, so I think I'm going to be dead by August. And and then set about to prepare for it. And he had already moved a few or a year before into an apartment where he wouldn't have to walk upstairs because he knew that this was could be happening. And his wishes before he died would be that he would finish the book he was working on and that he would record the audio book for it. And so he finished the book 3 weeks before, and then he was very, very sick. And then and I offered to record the audiobook with him because the publisher wasn't like ready to, you know, just like, you know, I was his friend who had a studio. And so he and I went into the studio 4 times and recorded the audiobook. He was very, very weak. And then the last time that he recorded with me was one of the last times he ever left his house. And then he died about a week and a half after that. And it was sobering to see somebody go through that, who's a peer, and to handle it with such I don't know, he just handled it all very thoughtfully and deliberately. I mean, I've had other people I've been close to die, but nobody who so openly acknowledged it to himself and tried to make preparations and tried to deal with that.
This American Life tribute that you put together was really very moving. I think all listeners really had a special moment listening to that episode, especially about David.
It was a weird week to put it together. I mean, he had just died, and so I had a week where I was sitting in my office basically like listening to old pieces and pulling tape and writing and just feeling so sad. And then in between that, going out to promote our movie, it was like, okay, now time to shoot a funny video. Okay, now back to like feeling really sad.
Right. Well, speaking of that next tea, which we hope is going to be a tea for triumph in the film. But before we talk about the film, can we just touch a bit on the changing media landscape? I think WBEZ and This American Life in particular were at the forefront of moving into podcasting, social media. And now all of that is ubiquitous. And promoting something like this film through social media must also be essential, as you've had to deal with the monster of publicizing and promoting the film, and on a tiny budget, from what I understand.
No, it's true. I mean, KALW did a screening last night at the Embarcadero, and I was really struck. And I think I said even to the audience, like we've been going to these screenings. Mike Birbiglia, who made the film with me, and we would ask the audience, like, okay, so who is here because you heard us personally, like you heard me or Mike actually ask you to come out, and every hand in the room goes up because they either heard it on the podcast or they heard it on the radio or they saw it on our Facebook feed or I saw it on Mike's Facebook or Twitter feed. And you know, it's a small film with a small budget made as a labor of love. And so there's no TV ads, you know, there's none of the stuff that you use to market a big movie. And so we felt like our one asset was that we could reach out to the people who know the radio show and who know Mike. And I would say that up until now, you know, we've done press, we've tried to get press, and besides the press that we've been able to get, like the biggest part of the marketing campaign has been social media.
Obviously, a help with no budget to do anything for paid print.
Exactly. I mean, there's print advertisements in some newspapers, but that's about it. And I think it's okay. Like, I feel like, you know, like I feel like, I don't know, people came out to the screenings the first weekend in New York, and the thing that we're trying to figure out is, like, people came out in New York in record numbers, but Mike and I were at every screening, whereas here in San Francisco, like, we're in theaters in Palo Alto and in the city and in Berkeley, and Mike is only doing a couple of screenings Sunday in the city at the Embarcadero and Monday at Berkeley at Shattuck. But, like, the rest of them, like, we're really needing to, you know, we hope that people will show up just like they show up for a regular movie without us. Like, I feel like we had a really good first weekend because we were there. And now we're just like, okay, well, now let's see what happens if people show up when we're not there. So this weekend will be the test to see if people come out. We're in kind of a mock war with the Avengers. Joss Whedon, who directed The Avengers, declared mock war on us. And then we declared mock war back on him in videos on the internet. Where we said that we would make every dollar that the Avengers made plus $1. So our official goal as a film is to make $1.5 billion and $1. And then it was just like, was it like a joke? You know, it started off as a joke, and then it's like that Onion headline, sort of a famous-y Onion headline, which was ironic porn purchase leads to unironic ejaculation, where like the joke became the truth, because the opening night of our film, like the opening weekend of our film, we actually beat the Avengers per screen average for opening night. We made over $60,000 and they per screen, and they made $47,000 per screen. Though as a reporter, I feel like there's an asterisk I should say, and that is that they were on way more screens. They were on 4,000 screens. We were on one screen. So their total take was, but that aside, for our one screen, we totally trounced that Joss Whedon.
That reminds me of a recent anecdote that Robert Reich had come up with, saying the problem with averages. He said, you know, Robert Reich said, you know, the average height of myself and Michael Jordan is 6'4". And Robert Reich's about just under 5 feet tall.
It's funny.
Problem with averages. Let's talk about the cast. What a stellar cast. Carol Kane, which I think most folks remember from Taxi. Lauren Ambrose from 6 Feet Under. And with a great singing voice, by the way, in one of those scenes. Lawrence,
yeah, she sings with a band. Like we knew that, like, hiring Lauren, we would get her to sing.
That's great. And so tell me how you got those folks on board.
I mean, Lauren, you know, Mike reached out to, Mike's wife was just like, she would be good for Abby, for the girlfriend. Because basically we wanted somebody who seemed really strong and they're in a relationship where they might break up, and we didn't want people to feel sorry for her, you know, and in any way. And so we knew we needed somebody sort of strong and somebody who's very funny. And she was really game and came to readings that we did when we were workshopping the script. And then Carol had been part of a casting process for a pilot with Mike years ago, and they stayed in touch, and he always wanted to cast her as his mom. And Carol says that, like, she's like, when you're Carol King, like, people are constantly saying to you, I really want to work with you, I'll cast you. And she's like, Mike is the only one who's ever actually, like, made it happen.
Wow.
And she was really wonderful. She was, you know, like, in a group of people, there'll be somebody who'll be the mom of the group. And she, if there was a tense day on set or a tired day, she was the one to kind of, like, make a joke and put everybody at ease and comfort somebody. She's a really special person. And then for us, you know, for Mike and me, and I think some of the others in the crew and cast, like, to have somebody who was in Annie Hall, you know what I mean, in our movie.
That's great.
You know, I mean, it's, I don't know.
Oh, I should mention that there is, oh, can I give away your Alfred Hitchcock moment?
I'm in the film, yeah. I have a little cameo in the film.
Look for a wedding scene, I believe.
Yes.
So that's all we're going to give away. You have to see the film to see Ira and his Alfred Hitchcock moment. Now, was the film, except for it, a lot of road trip involved in the film, but was it for the most part shot in New York City?
In and around New York, yeah. Yeah, a lot of it is shot on Staten Island, which I had never been to Staten Island, but Staten Island is a very suburbsy place in New York, which is just a little boat ride from Manhattan.
And except for a memorable La Quinta scene.
Yeah.
Now, that's actually a scene from Mike Birbiglia's real life.
Yeah.
And I guess the inspiration for the film. Could you, for people that don't know what Sleepwalk With Me is about, why don't we give a quick little recap here?
Okay, so this isn't a spoiler because the poster of the film is a comedy for anybody who's had a dream and then jumped out a window. Basically, Mike, when he was in his 20s, I feel like I was like this in my 20s too. He wanted to have a career, doing some kind of creative work. He wanted to be a comedian. In his case, I wanted to do radio, and he wasn't very good at it, and nothing much was happening for him. And then he was also in a relationship with somebody, and it wasn't clear, like, should we stay together? What should we do? Like clearly some things about the relationship are working, but like, should we stay together? And his anxiety about what to do with both of those things is expressed through a series of increasingly spectacular sleepwalk incidents, which in real life, and all this is true, which in real life culminated with him jumping through the second story window of a hotel room at La Quinta Inn and nearly dying. And so that's the story.
Wow. Now, making the film experience must have been a totally different thing for me. You've probably had some preparation having moved from radio, or while you're still doing radio, into television.
I thought you were going to say, you probably have some preparation watching DVD extras. Yes, I had watched DVD extras, so I was very familiar with what happens in a movie set by watching DVD extras. Yes, I was 100% familiar.
Now, at last night's screening, you talked a bit about the evolution of the film, from early drafts to the reality of filming, and to even trying different endings with test audiences. You know, again, you're not working with a multi-million dollar budget here, so how did the film change from your original conception?
I mean, it changed a lot. To the test audiences that we had, is we would just go in our Facebook group for the radio show and say, we're working on this thing, we want to invite you to a screening, we're not going to say what it is, and, you know, coming out, we would get 40, 50, 60 people to come out to a little theater, and we would show them a cut of the film. We would do this two or three times a week, all last fall when we were editing the film. And some of the things that we changed were fixing things that people didn't understand. Like, for example, people did not get why... They didn't get the relationship. There's Mike and his girlfriend, and they're just like, we don't buy this relationship. Like, we just don't. Like, why is she with him? He's such a loser. She's such a smart, pretty girl. Like, she totally has it together. She's, like, totally this willful, great person. And so we tried to remake the story so that it made sense. And so honestly, so that was a big, big thing to deal with. And then the other thing is that people really love, one of the plot lines in the film is Mike going from being a terrible comedian to being a very good comedian. And you watch him go through changes and grow. And that always got a huge response. When he's a terrible comedian, it's really funny to watch him flounder and bomb. And then when
he must have in his early career.
Yeah, he very much did. Yeah. And then he makes some changes in how he thinks about what he does on stage, and then gets to be quite good. And then, you know, you get to see him on stage, and he's really funny. And honestly, at some point we became kind of like laugh horrors. We're just like, we're writing a comedy, we need more laughs. Oh, wait a second, we have this one special gift. We have a professional comedian who works on the film who's starring in it. We could just put him on stage and filming him being really super funny. And so we added to the stand-up comedy in the film. And we did all kinds of fixes. There were fixes that I had never heard of that you do to fix a film. So, for example, with the relationship between Mike and the girlfriend, we did a fix that apparently is a very traditional movie fix that, in fact, screenwriters kind of hate because it's kind of a hacky sort of fix. We did a save the cat fix. And the idea is you have the character do something like save a cat so that people like the character. And so the movie actually begins with a 38 – there's a little prologue, and then there's a 38-second scene, which is our Save the Cat scene, that in which Mike – all that happens in the scene, it doesn't advance the plot in any way. Mike shows up at work to pick up his girlfriend. He gives her some nuts and some water. They crack some jokes. She signs a card for a party they're going to. They say another joke or two, and that's the whole scene. And the only message the scene conveys is, oh, these people have kind of a nice thing. They're kind of a nice couple. And honestly, before we put that scene in, people didn't buy them as a couple. And then after we put the scene in, they did. And I had never conceived that that was a thing. That, like, you could just do... And everything else in the film is the same. It's like it, but everything else became more believable because of it.
Now, as a musician, I have to ask about the soundtrack, which is great, by the way. No complaints there, but as some of our listeners may be aware, you have a rather well-regarded composer cousin by the name of Philip.
Yes.
Now, why didn't you ask him to do the soundtrack?
Philip's quote was not small enough for our film. When you hire Philip Glass, you know, you're competing against the Berlin Symphony and the Met. You know what I mean? Like, you really have to come up with some green to get Philip on board.
No family ties for that one.
I mean, truthfully, like, now that I say that, I think that I could get Philip to score something for us for sure, but to do an entire film is a huge amount of work. And honestly, you have to book him way in advance. Like, he is booked for the next 2 or 3 years. Philip loves to collaborate, and now that you say this, I realize, like, I could get him, but I'd have to book well in advance. And really, like, I don't know if he would do a whole score. And also, it's funny because, you know, the one thing, like, he and I have talked about collaborating on doing something on stage, and I've always thought the one thing that I would love to push him to do is to do music for something that's funny, because he himself is very funny, and very funny, like, very, very funny in person. And no one ever commissions anything funny from him. They're always commissioning, like, you know, dark, big, dark, epic things. And it would be interesting to hear him do it. And so maybe someday if we do another comedy, we can see if he'd be in.
Well, you can see a full list. You'll enjoy the soundtrack, by the way, folks. You can see a full list of theaters where the film Sleepwalk With Me is scheduled at sleepwalkmovie.com. You can also see some great trailers that you guys put together to promote the film there. Tomorrow, it's opening in Palo Alto, San Francisco, Berkeley, and Campbell. And on the 7th of September, it's showing in Piedmont. Mike Birbiglia will be at some of those screenings.
He's going to be at Sunday at the Embarcadero for a couple screenings and Monday in Berkeley at the Shattuck for a couple screenings.
Fantastic. Ira Glass, what a pleasure it's been talking with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Please keep on doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
Well, I don't have the soundtrack to Sleepwalk With Me, but I do have some music from Ira's cousin, Philip. Here is The Grid from the soundtrack to Koyaanisqatsi, music of Philip Glass on Open Air. Music from the soundtrack to Koyaanisqatsi. Music of Philip Glass here on KALW, and I'm David LaTulip in for Alan Farley. It seems like we're all things glass considered this afternoon here on Open Air. A reminder that the Ira Glass, Mike Birbiglia film, opens tomorrow night at the Embarcadero Film Center. More information about those screenings at sleepwalkmovie.com. Well, the fall season is already upon us with lots of innovative programming ahead for our Bay Area eyes and ears. One of those important cultural elements is the Berklee Symphony's new season. Here is Open Air host Alan Farley talking recently with Berklee Symphony Music Director Joanna Carneiro and Executive Director Renee Mandel.
Joining me now to talk about the 2012-2013 Berklee Symphony season, Maestra Joanna Carneiro. Welcome back, Joanna.
Hi, Alan. Thank you.
And Executive Director Renee Mandel. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Alan.
Well, to me, it looks like a very exciting season. You've got a world premiere in every concert.
Well, thank you, Alan. We're very proud of that. Renee and I discussed this while we were programming for next season, and it's a privilege to be able to fulfill this mission to commission. So to have one new piece in each concert, plus a piece that has been written really in the past 100 years, and then something from the past, from maybe 200 years ago. So it's a privilege to fulfill this mission that we have, and with such exciting composers.
Renee, how do you and Joanna work together on planning the season?
Well, we put a bunch of names in a hat and just start picking them out. what happens is we talk about the season in general. I ask her, what would she like to do? What are her dream pieces that she wants to do? And so we get that all down on paper, and we consider which ones are realistic, which ones are completely, no matter what, probably not a good idea, and some that might be, well, that actually could work. And there's a variety of reasons that we need to choose these pieces, and there has to be a balance between, of course, what our audience wants, what Joanna's passion is. And it's very, very important for me that, and I know for Joanna, that Joanna only conducts works that she feels a very, very deep passion and connection with, for the most part, obviously. So with the commissioning, we had Paul Drescher. Well, I'll back up a minute. We had been discussing a dream that we had, which would be to have a commission on every program. And we thought, this would be great to do every season, maybe, who knows. And for next season, there was already the Paul Drescher commission that would open the season and the Stephen Stuckey commission that would end the season. And I called Joanna one day and said, you know, what if we find a couple of composers to fill out the middle concerts? She said, great. So that's what happened.
And so how did you choose the composers?
So one of them, Andrea Pinto Correia, she's Portuguese, and she's been on my radar for a few years. She hasn't been composing for a long, long time, about 5 years, I think. And she's had premieres. Carnegie Hall, Minnesota Orchestra just premiered a piece of hers. She lives in Princeton. She has a residency there. So she's been doing very well. She's from Lisbon, as I am. And even though we don't really know each other, I know her music, and I've talked to other composers, more experienced composers that have spoken very highly of her around the world. So she's been somebody that I've wanted to commission for a long time and know. So Andrea, for me, was an easy choice, and somebody from my country. And she really brings our culture into her music. Her piece will be about Alfama, which is the oldest neighborhood in Lisbon, medieval neighborhood. And so she will bring not only the geographical perception, I hope, but also some of our musical traditions into her music. And she does it in a beautiful way with great craft. So I'm very proud that we are commissioning Andrea. And the other composer, Dylan Mattingly, came through you, actually, Renee. You were the one who introduced me to him.
Well, let me interject. Actually, it was Sarah Cahill who introduced Dylan Manning to me and said, check this guy out. I think he'd be great. Here's his dad's information. He'll get you a CD. And so his dad immediately delivered something, and I listened to it and sent it off to Joanna and said, this could be perfect.
And Dylan was part of our other program, the Under Construction program, a few years ago. So it all made sense that all these wonderful musicians were speaking highly of him, that we immediately had a good reaction to his music and the fact that he was already part of the Berklee Symphony family. So that's in short how we came up with the four commissions for next season.
Well, and you've got some great soloists coming in, Shai Wozner and Lynn Harrell.
Yes, we were very lucky to get that. Shai Wozner and I worked together in St. Paul with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra about a year and a half ago. And I asked him, would you like to do something with the Berklee Symphony? And he said, yes, I would love to play the Ligeti. And I said, that's perfect.
Terrific,
what a perfect piece to do with us. And then Renee got us Lynn Harrell. Really, it was Renee's doing. And of course, I've been such a fan of Lynn's for a long, long time. And I think with the centennial and everything, Lutoslavsky, Renee and Lynn discussed which piece for him to play. And they came up with Lutoslavsky. So it was a perfect ending to this connection that Renee brought to us. And finally, Paul Drescher will be his own soloist because he's playing the quadricord and the hurdy-gurdy. The instruments that he invents. Paul Drescher is not only a fantastic composer, but he's invents these instruments, the quadricord and the gurdy-gurdy, right? That's the name.
Hurdy-gurdy.
Is that okay? He is writing a piece for the quadricord and the hurdy-gurdy and orchestra, and he will be the soloist. And at the end of the season, Stephen Stuckey is writing a piece for a wonderful tenor, Noah Stewart, who I have worked with several times. He has sung The Prince on a Flowering Tree on a few occasions, and we did a concert together in London with the Liverpool, the Royal Liverpool Orchestra, and he's a former Adler Fellow. So again, a great connection to our area.
Well, and you're doing some of my favorite music, the Beethoven Seventh, the Rachmaninoff Symphonic Dances, and the Bruckner Symphony.
Yes.
The Bruckner Fourth.
What about Schumann II?
And Schumann II. Yes. Well, those are pieces that, of course, I adore, and Bruckner will be something new for me, I have to say. As a composer, of course, I've studied his music. I've assisted many conductors in the music, but it will be my debut with Bruckner. And it feels like this is the time. I've spoken to my mentors about this at length, and they have encouraged me, and so has Renee. So it feels like the orchestra and I are ready for that. And I think starting with Beethoven and then Schumann and the music that we've been playing, Brahms, a lot of Beethoven in the past few years, seems like they have been wonderful steps to finish our season with Bruckner.
I'm going to say something here that could either be cut out or not, so it's just something. Well, the Schumann Ligeti Dylan Mattingly program is a perfect example of a program that we can do in Berklee because we have the audiences who will support that and who crave that kind of programming. It's also an example of one of the reasons we program things. Schumann II is an extraordinary symphony, and it's actually one of Joanna's absolute favorites. And in the process of doing this, there was a concern that, well, people don't know Schumann that well, or people may, that, you know, who knows, if how is that going to sell? And we went round and round on this, and ultimately, the Ligeti and the Schumann have a certain kind of connection, a symbiosis that can really be felt once it's heard. And having Dylan Mattingly come in and write something, and he's very aware of what's on the rest of the program, to that he will probably open that program, be followed by the Ligeti and then Schumann. People will have any concert experience that they rarely, if ever, have had. They will be absolutely surprised. It will surpass any kind of expectations they will have in that concert, hearing these pieces, and particularly Schumann. It'll open them up, and suddenly people may not know Schumann or might be shy away from him, will probably crave to hear some of his other works. So ultimately, in the end, it was, yes, we're going to do this. Why, you know, if we can't program like this in Berkeley, then there's really nothing unique about Berkeley Symphony.
And we know that there is. Well, Renee Mandel and Joanna Carnaro, thank you for spending some time with us on this broadcast.
Thank you for having us, Alan.
Thank you very much.
Alan Farley with Joanna Carnaro and Renee Mandel from the Berkeley Symphony Orchestra. By the way, KALW will be broadcasting this season's October 4th opening concert featuring Paul Drescher and his aforementioned specially created quadricord later in December. And closer to the current calendar, on Sunday, September 16th at 4 p.m., we'll broadcast their April concert, which was guest conducted by Edwin Atwater on the theme A Hungarian Excursion. So tune in Sunday, September 16th for our next Berkeley Symphony broadcast. I'm David Latulippe in for Alan Farley for this week's Open Air, and I'm pleased to welcome back to the studios Peter Robinson, who is our cultural correspondent. Peter, welcome back.
Hi, David. Good to see you.
I understand you've been a busy guy.
I've been a busy guy, yes. I've been to theater, I've been to movies, and I've had some exciting summer reading, which I'll be happy to suggest for those who are still traveling at the end of August and September.
Well, let's start with some theater events.
So we started over at the East Bay at California Shakespeare, which, in case you're not familiar with it, is a beautiful outdoor theater.
Embarrassed to say I have not yet made it to that venue. I'm hoping to at some point. Well, 10 years in the Bay Area and I still haven't made it over there.
Well, while the summer and the autumn exists, it's well worth a trip. You can get there by public transportation. And they have a shuttle that meets Bart in Arinda, takes you up to the theater. And the show that I've just finished reviewing, has got a few more days to run. And it is Noel Coward, one of Alan Farley's favorites, Blithe Spirit. This has all the wordplay and all the whimsy and all the wit of Noel Coward. It has an interesting backstory. The word spirit is important because it's about the ghost of a person's first wife coming back to haunt him in his second marriage. Coward actually wrote the play in a remarkable time length, 5 days after his house had been bombed during the Blitz in London in 1941. And I mention that because any belief in seances, in spiritualism, often has a higher percentage of interest in wartime periods when people are killed, dead ones are conjured up out of nowhere to speak to the people in the seance. Now, this is not a seance. This is what I call a dining room drama. And the two lead characters, René Argueson and Paul Fusco, I had actually seen in the same production at ACT about 5 years ago. But interestingly enough, René was playing the first wife. Now, as time progresses, she plays the second wife. So from the point of view of theatre, all the wit and all the witticisms, and I think the difference between Coward and Oscar Wilde, Coward's wit is the conversational type of wit, which you would get at a dinner party or around a table or in a salon. Oscar Wilde tends to be more epigrammatic. So this is really ideal for the theatre. And I've mentioned it's an outdoor production. My recommendation is to go on Sunday at 4 o'clock, just as the sun is setting behind the hills. But they also offer you a blanket, because after the sun's gone down, it can get chilly in this theatre. And as the story progresses, the trick with this play is that the second wife cannot hear the ghost speaking. So the wit of the situation is the second wife is speaking to the husband, reminding him of what their first marriage was like and making comparisons. And the play really does a wonderful job at taking you back to the great age of what I call conversation, of dinner parties of the 1930s. The costumes are great, the set works well, and certainly the evening I was there, the audience loved it. One other tip about Cow Shakespeare is arrive early. The dramaturge, Philippa Kelly, gives an excellent exposition on what you're going to see. It reminds me a little bit of Alistair Cook in the old days of Masterpiece Theatre, mm-hmm. where you get the story ahead of time, you know what to look for, and you're all set. Bring a picnic, bring a bottle of wine, sit at a table, enjoy the outdoor scenery, and that is running for a few more days. It's had an extended run. The play is Blythe Spirit. The company is California Shakespeare Company. And, of course, it is by that classic 20th century playwright whose plays have been constantly run right through until today. Every bit is topical. Blythe Spirit by Noel Coward.
And, of course, Noel Coward, a very important part of KLW's airwaves as well, is every Friday evening, thanks to Alan Farley's due diligence. He provides a Noel Coward on-tract, a tune of Noel Coward's relating to what's happening on the My Music and My Word series from the BBC. So tune in right at 8:30 this tomorrow evening for
it's a nice bridge between My Word and My Music. And as Noel Coward would say, I'll see you again.
Indeed.
This classic song.
What else we have on the theatre front, Peter?
So I've now been over to Marin Theatre Company, which is in Mill Valley. And that, too, has been extended. It's a play called Circle Mirror Transformations. It's by Annie Baker, who has had quite some success in the Bay Area with recent plays, including Body Awareness, The Aliens, which was at the San Francisco Playhouse earlier this year in March. And I think this play will appeal to anybody who has done acting classes. The set, which is a very sort of bare studio with bouncing balls and looks a bit like a gym without the equipment. And the actors are now going to be trained in improv. So it's a play about self-discovery. And each of the actors go through the various moves, from doing slow walking to fast walking. A lot of psychology thrown in. I think that would appeal to theatre goers in Marin County, the world of psychobabble. And it's a real life performance. The director, Kim Fagan, has carried what was pretty much, I saw this in New York, the entire practice and set. And Peter Callender, who people may well know because he was in Spunk, which played at Cow Shakes in the previous play, takes the lead. So as the troupe go through their improvised acting performances, we see the struggles. And if ever you've been to one of these improv classes, they are never quite what you expect them to be, hence the word improv.
Indeed.
And one of the actors on set asks, when are we going to start acting? And of course, that comes three quarters way through the production, where you already realize that, as the name suggests, circle mirror transformation, the transformation is actually happening. The four students blend in age. Peter Callender, of course, is the most experienced. One is a divorced man by the name of Schlutz, and we never find out quite what his backstory is. But he, too, goes through a self-learning, or shall we say self-actualization, about what life is all about. It runs for 2 hours. It doesn't have an intermission. And I think it's a tribute to the cast that you get so engaged or so involved that you actually don't miss the intermission. So that's running, again, an extended run. It's at the Marin Theatre Company, which is in Mill Valley.
Do we have a website for them, perhaps, for more information?
Now I've been on to the movies, so let's change from what I call live theatre to the silver screen. And the first film is really a documentary, quite an extraordinary film. It is called The Imposter. And I think if it wasn't based on a true story, you would actually question the authenticity. This is a story of a man, and I emphasize the word man, who is aged 23, and he passes himself off in real life to a family in Texas as a 16-year-old. And the backstory is the 16-year-old boy has gone missing. The Texas family don't know what has happened to him, where he's been. And this particular person, who I want to add is Algerian and French and has dark eyes, is accepted by the family as the returned son. The son who went missing was blonde and had blue eyes. He is picked up in Spain. He's returned to the United States, and he claims that he has been kidnapped, that he's been tortured, and that he has been brainwashed, which in brainwashed it means that he doesn't speak exactly with an American accent. And as I say, I want to emphasize it's a documentary. It's based on a real-life story. The family accepts him. You see the opening scene when he is met at the airport in Texas, at Houston. And even when it comes to the immigration, they check him out and he passes the immigration test. Next, the FBI get involved. And lo and behold, the FBI accept him. But the trick in the story is a investigator, a private detective. And the private detective, who is played by the real-life character who actually investigates him, doesn't feel the story hangs together. Now, The Impostors had rave reviews both in Europe, particularly in the Guardian newspaper, and in New York, and it's making fleeting visits here in the Bay Area. So really, it's the story of a trickster who essentially believes in himself, believes in his own story, and sets out to deceive this family in San Antonio, wanting them to accept him, which they do, as their missing son. And I think the extraordinary thing is it's a 23-year-old who is actually in real life playing a 16-year-old. And eventually, it has an interesting end.
Interesting. So do you have some of the screens where it's playing on? Do we know some of the theaters where it's
Yeah,
being
that's
screened?
Been at the Embarcadero, and it's, I think, coming to the Lumiere next week. It's going to be one of those shorter-type films which won't get huge publicity. So it's well worth watching and well worth looking for, and that is The Impostor. And, of course, it does have a surprise ending. He does get discovered, but I won't give you the intricacies of how the private investigator pulls it off.
Peter Robinson on the film The Impostor. Good afternoon. I'm David LaTulipe in for Alan Farley. Peter, have another movie perhaps, or should we move on to books?
Yeah. Well, two movies, kind of back-to-back, sort of interesting. One is called Lawless, which has just opened, and this is at major theaters throughout the Bay Area and in San Francisco and in Marin. I recommend seeing it on the big screen because it is a what I call a really a moonshine saga, a prohibition crime drama, and again based this time on a true story. It was based on a novel called The Wettest County in the World, which is happens to be in West Virginia, and it's the story of prohibition. With a couple of big names, Floyd Banner, the gangster, is played by Gary Oldman, and the kind of anti-heroic family are the Budarini brothers, who are hillbillies who brew and smuggle moonshine from Franklin County in Virginia. Now, it's not a great movie, but I like the scenery, I like the setup, and certainly in terms of giving me a feel for prohibition, I think from a social historian's point of view, it gives you that sense. The scenery, of course, are the hills and the mountains, the backwoods. It's got some violence in it. The investigation involves gunfights and shootings, so you're not going to see happy hillbillies just getting high. But what you will see, I think, is insightful. And it kind of dovetails a little into other movies of this period, Bonnie and Clyde, The Godfather, The Untouchables, and a series which I did enjoy by Ken Burns, actually called Prohibition. So you get that sense of what history was like. But I can only add one word, lawless. It's not flawless. It's another story.
I understand you have another
film. Could be beaten up.
I understand you have another film which is actually in direct contrast to Prohibition.
That's right. Yeah, you're absolutely right, David. And this is My Name is Bill W. It's running in San Rafael at the main theater there. And of course, it is the story of the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you want to go from Prohibition to AA, here's your chance. This is a very well-done biography. It does not sanctify Bill W. It shows you his flaws. It shows you his greatness, his contribution to really the antidote to alcoholism. And again, it's got some original footage actually made before he died. So two interesting back-to-back films, Lawless, A Moonshine Saga, and My Name is Bill W., How to Kick the Habit.
Well, some wonderful suggestions there, Peter. I know we want to spend at least a couple of minutes of some upcoming things, perhaps something that you know of that's coming up this weekend that someone should catch or hear or see.
Yeah, a couple of things. At Cal Shakes, the Shakespearean period finishes with their production of Hamlet, and this, again, opens and runs through October. This is really the end of their Shakespeare season. They began with The Tempest, and so which is a kind of light one, and now we're into the great tragedy or one of Shakespeare's great plays, Hamlet. The San Francisco Literary Society at the University Club is going to be starting its series in September, which is turning books into movies. And this is for people who read, but people who also like the silver screen. And the opening film there is an Australian movie called Muriel's Wedding, which did very well several years ago. And if you want more information about the San Francisco Literary Society and you want to reach for a pen and paper, here's a number to call. It's 415-381-6671. That's the San Francisco Literary Society's series, Turning Books into Movies at the University Club. And again, the number 415-381-6671.
Thank you so much, Peter. We'll have your book review perhaps on another edition of Open Air. A couple of things I wanted to mention is that the Sausalito Art Festival celebrates 60 years this weekend. You can learn more at sausalitoartfestival.org. And Hitchcock's classic film Vertigo is at the Castro Theater this weekend in glorious 70mm film stock. Castro Theater, that's theater R-E. CastroTheater.com. I should also mention that Alan Farley can be heard tonight as part of the Noel Coward Entract tomorrow evening at 8:30. He'll also be host for his occasional series, I Love to Rhyme. You can hear that next installment of I Love to Rhyme tomorrow evening at 10 in place of Voice Box. And his series, My Favorite Things, returns again on Monday. He has an installment with Michael Gene Sullivan, actor and playwright with the San Francisco Mime Troupe. I'm David Latulli. That's all the time we have for today's Open Air. Thanks for listening, and we hope to see you online at kalw.org. Perhaps you're able to make a secure contribution to help shorten our upcoming pledge drive at kalw.org. Thank you, and enjoy the weekend.